Welcome to the Sacred Stew. This is your host, James, and my co-host, Anthony. And tonight, we are going to start talking about the Golden Age and getting into the transition of when Heimdall or Rig came to Earth. So since our episode last week, and do you want to do the recap from last week a little bit to catch people up that haven't listened to this episode so they have an idea of where we kind of started at with the creation myth two episodes ago, and then what we covered last week and where we're at today?
Okay, so with the creation myth, we touched on everything from Gnunga Gap and Niflheim being on one side, Muspelheim being on the other, the two sides meeting in the middle, the creation happening. We got Adhumbla, we got Ymir, we got Buri getting licked out of the ice. We touched on Odin, Hodor, and Lodor slaying Ymir for killing Adhumbla. And then the peace treaty that was signed after that, the creation of Midgard and Mannheim and Asgard. And then last week, we touched a lot on Yggdrasil, kind of coming to the understanding that it's kind of the embodiment of all trees. Not just an ash or an oak or a yew. You gave a really interesting perspective of the apple tree, and Idun getting her apples that keeps the gods young from Yggdrasil. And then we touched on the creation of Mimir creating the dark elves, and the various man-like beings that were created before the first man and woman, who were asking Embla two pieces of driftwood, one an ash, one an elm, found on a beach, that to keep it super basic, between Odin, Hodor, and Lodor, they gave us what we would recognize as the physical, the mental, and the spiritual capabilities. And then we're moving in now to talking about how Rig came down and kind of added another layer to humanity with giving us the three classes of beings.
Right. And that kind of goes with how you ended the episode last week too, about the questions of other sorts of beings coming to be as well. Yeah. One thing that I do before we actually jump into the coming of Rig, I wanted to backtrack a little bit and talk about the lore and the story of Ask and Embla being created, because there's something really significant with that specific part of the lore. And I had mentioned, I believe it was in episode 2. And for those of you that haven't started at the beginning of our series of podcasts, I do highly recommend that you begin at the very beginning. That way you have a complete picture of where we're at in this conversation. But if you don't feel like it, that's fine. Each episode definitely can serve as its own independent show for you to listen to and get information on. But you'll have a much better picture if you follow from the very beginning. With Ask and Embla, when they were created, in episode 2, I had mentioned about how the lore is very layered. And there's lots of layers to it. I had heard one person actually in the past week. It's funny how these conversations come up in circles, but I had heard somebody mention in a podcast this week I was listening to about what makes the lore sacred is the tradition of telling stories, being a good storyteller, right? And not so much like the information that's in the story. And I fundamentally disagree with that position. For me, in the way I see it, is that the lore is sacred, not for the act of storytelling, but for the act of relaying information from one generation to the next. And that information is historical. It is also spiritual. And it also is physical in the sense of providing us an understanding of how we should live our life, like a guidebook. And with the story of the creation of Ask and Embla, this is an example of the lore being very layered as well. Because not only is it describing the creation of man and woman by the gods in a very, I guess you can call it a descriptive way, but what it's also doing is it's telling you how to actually make your idols too. It's telling you how to actually bring life to your idols. I know a lot of people in polytheism, they have idols, they buy different idols from different vendors and this and that, and they make really good knickknacks, they look great, they pray to them. But there was actually a practice from our ancestors in how they would put the spirit of the god into that idol so he is present there and living. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't. I always thought it was just the practice of using the practice itself of using the idols, the statues, god poles, whatever your preference is. And it was that act that I almost kind of look at him like when we've talked about like having the right number, I always just thought of the idols as a specific cell phone that can only dial a specific number.
Yeah, I mean, that's true on a very basic level understanding of it. But and you can put power into it by, you know, the repetition of the acts of ritual that you're doing. But there is a very, very specific way to call the spirits of the gods into an idol. And there was a ritual, and that ritual was called Shmirta. And we see the same ritual performed in other Indo-European traditions as well. And for those just tuning in or still not really clear what the Indo-Europeans are, and this is an important discussion to have that we'll probably get into a little bit tonight, since we are going to be discussing the coming of Rig, is that there was a broader folk of our ancestors that is classified as Indo-European, and that the Indo-Europeans spread south and west, coming from the north, and that each one of those tribes that spread had slight variations in their language shifts of pronunciation of different consonants and vowels, which made the languages sort of like different dialects of each other. And but they're all part of a very similar tradition that has its origins from a single place. So although I'm not saying that, for example, as Germanic pagans or heathens, that we should, you know, look at another Indo-European tradition that isn't German to get our traditions or rituals from, we can look at them to say, hey, this exists in ours, or I have an idea that this might be something that we, our ancestors did. Is this something that actually existed in other Indo-European traditions? And if the answer is yes, then we can assume that we probably had something very similar. Shmirta is one of those examples where there was an actual ritual that you would perform, rubbing sacred herbs and sacred oils into your idol while chanting a Galdar chant. And it was a very specific chant that was said. And you would do this chant 9 times. And after each repetition of the Galdar chant, you would blow onto the idol, like Odin blowing the Ond into the first man and woman. So this is something that existed, and it is one of those stories that have carried on. That's not just the history of where the first man and woman came from, but also the gods instructing us on how to create living idols of them as well.
I've never heard of this before. This is super interesting.
I've heard you say that a few times in episodes.
Well, when I haven't heard a song before, it's the best response I got. No, it's so, all right. So okay, so this I'm gonna slaughter the pronunciation. You said it's Shmurta?
Yeah, Shmurta.
Okay. You said this process contains galdering and rubbing it with herbs and oils?
Yeah, very sacred herbs. And then essentially like cow milk. And there's a very specific galder that has to be chanted. And no, I'm not, galder is not, a lot of people think galder is just chanting the runes themselves. That's not actually what galder is. Galder is a very, very specific form of recitation of the poems or a way of speaking where there's a certain amount of words and consonants in a sentence, and there's a rule pattern to how the galder happens from line to line.
So where, outside of us, where would people be able to learn about this?
Well, you know, with the folk knowledge, there is a certain amount of it that can be public information, but there's also a certain amount of it that is private information that's just shared between people on how to do that. And that's because it is incumbent upon us as being Asa true to the Aesir, that we protect the honor of the gods. And there are people out there that are practicing all sorts of weird things that have nothing to do with our faith or our ancestors. And I would hate to give them information that would allow them to do something that dishonors our gods in some way or attack our gods in some way.
Of course.
So, you know me personally, over time, you know, I when we get together, I can teach you about it.
So in other words, folks, find someone.
Yeah. What do you think about people thinking that there are not many pagans out there?
But I don't know. Like, I guess to a certain degree, I know I felt the same way for a while. But then once you find out that there are more pagans out there, then you really start having to filter through that. It's a very good possibility there's not going to be very many pagans or heathens on the same mental note as you are. And right. So to a certain degree, I think it's a matter of perspective. That's difficult because, you know, especially from our perspective.
Yeah, it's a matter of culture as well. I mean, and you think of this, like I was a lone practitioner for a long time. And the only reason why I came out of, I guess you could say, my cave is because of my children, you know, because I was teaching them the old ways and they would go to school and they would be the only ones. They would think they're the only ones. They're the only ones not celebrating Christmas, or they have some holidays that are different and weird to the other kids. And so I wanted to show them, like, you know, hey, no, we're not the only people that believe in this faith. And yeah. So then I started to get involved in some different groups and organizations throughout my area, our area. And not only was I very, very happy to find other pagans, I was very, very surprised at how large of a community actually existed in our area. And it's a beautiful community, and it is something that I cherish, and my kids are very involved in, and we are doing great things, building up community, building the folk throughout the region that we're in. So I know that there's people out there that think that there's not, you know, very many pagans out there, but I definitely want to relay the message that there are folks. You do have to just reach out and find them, though.
Yeah, speaking for our region, it's definitely a lot bigger than what I had initially thought before I got to the point where I just felt so stagnant and a lot of other personal stuff that it's like, okay, I just had to find somebody else.
Right.
But it's bigger than I thought it is, but it's not as big as I would like it to be. So that's definitely a goal.
Right. That's, you know, and we talked to in another episode, and anytime we talk about Rig, we always have to talk about community building, because he was the bringer of culture. You know, he was the person that taught us our religion. And so if we're to do any sort of community building in today's age, we have to look at the lessons of what he actually brought to us and why it's important. You've probably heard people say things like, well, we can't look at the past. We have to, you know, focus on the now and here and the future. And that's a true statement. But for me, that's a very, very hollow statement, because it negates what the very essence of our faith is. Our faith is the connection to the past. It is, you know, our point of origin, where we come from, and it provides us the purpose of why we keep going forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like when I think about it, we're a branch on a greater tree, and we can't just pretend that we're a new tree without roots going back significantly farther.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but it does go back to the example that we gave in a few episodes ago about, you know, putting your energy and power into like a boulder that's already rolling, where you can either try to push a new boulder and get it going, or you can jump on board with a boulder that already has momentum to it and add your force and power to it to make it that much faster and stronger. It's that very same concept of what we're talking about here. And looking at Rig, because I do want to jump into this, I want to keep to the timeline pretty much in every episode. And going into where we left off last week with the creation of man in the golden age, the Gul Alda, we talked about previously about after the slaying of Ymir and the creation of Midgard and the Odin assigning authority to different things, to different gods and Jotun. And there was like a peace compact between all the various tribes, the Vanir, the Jotun, the Elfin, and the Aesir. And there were hostages that were traded between the tribes. This was a common practice of the gods, and it was also a practice of our folk. This is what we did to make sure that peace treaties were kept, because now we have part of your family. And if you attack us, you're also attacking your family too. So, but when this happens, if you recall, this is kind of where Gullveig Hæid enters the story. And for those just kind of tuning in here, she's the one that is killed three times by the gods, but regenerates. So we have to start talking a little bit about the transition of the golden age, or from the Ur age into the golden age, and then also slightly touch a little bit into the next age, the Silver Age, the Silver Age, because it's not exactly clear when certain aspects of Gullveig's behavior was manifest, and exactly clear, like at what exact point she was killed. Although I have my own ideas when these happen, but we do know that she was killed three times by the gods, and she regenerated each time. So this also gets into a little bit understanding about how the souls work, which we touched a little bit on last week with describing about how Urd chooses the soul. Holner delivers the soul, or has the authority of delivering it, but the Disir deliver it to the mother. So we're going to have to touch a little bit on that. Hopefully we can get all of that crammed in tonight. If not, we're definitely going to follow up next week with the soul portion, because this is a very important part of understanding our folk's soul and how the mechanics of it work. But with Gullveig Hæid, when she had come to the Aesir as a hostage, she didn't really give any appearance of causing ill. You know, the Jotun were mostly devastated and mostly killed by the flood of Ymir's blood. There weren't many of them. They weren't a strong tribe. So they had no way of really doing harm to the Aesir. But over time, they began to breed and create more and more Jotun that were Thursar, that held an enmity in them about everything that had happened. And they really disliked the Aesir. And Govek Hyde, who is also known in the lore as Orboda or Engroboda, was a maiden of Frigga, technically, though she started working with Freya as a handmaiden. Part of the authority of Freya is regeneration of things. So I want to explain an important concept. You know that, for example, that we have bloats to Thor and Freyr and Njord for good crops and weather. And I know, do you know why we do those three specifically for that?
So the way I understood it, Thor gave protection for the crops and he hallowed it. And then Freyr, he was a god of abundance and fertility. Njord, I honestly don't know much about him other than him being tied to any, like fishing, for example. Like our ancestors, when they went out to fish, they would pray to Njord for a good catch.
Right.
So for Thor and Freyr, it's like Freyr has the seed and the and then Thor protects and makes holy the seed, and then Freyr makes it multiply. He creates the abundance. But Njord in that aspect, I'm not sure.
Hey, that's actually a very good take, and it's really spot on. And the reason why I was bringing this up is so people can understand Freya's role in this and how Govek Hyde came to be in the position that she's in. You're absolutely spot on in relation to like the bounties and harvests of crops and stuff. Thor protects and hallows. Freyr gives the bounty, the fruits, the seeds that come from the growth from the seed, right? And Njord provides the weather in the essentially the climate for it to grow properly. So that's why those three are specifically involved in that process. Freya comes in this. Freya and Freyr are children of Njord, so they inherited properties and authorities from them, from him. So Freya's aspect and role in this is the receiving of the seed and the regeneration of it. So, and she works the same way with the souls and death, where she regenerates souls as well. So this is an important concept because Govek Hyde, who at this time was known as Orboda or Engroboda, working as a handmaid, part of her job had to deal with fertility and delivering babies as a Disir. She had within her soul, in the qualities of her soul, a disposition to cause harm to things, and figured out a way, or a magical way, as the lore describes it, to cause things to be malformed. And when she did this, it, you know, caused the humans that Odin and his brothers had created to come out malformed, diseased, and with all sorts of problems. And so in order to combat that, this is one of the reasons. And it's not really clear in the lore exactly when this took place. But at some point, it could have been right before Rig came, or some people say it was after Rig came that this happened. I tend to believe that it happened right before Rig came, where Golveig Hyde and her malformations that she was causing and diseases that she was causing with new children of the folk, the gods discovered what she was doing and they killed her. And when they burned her, that's when Loki eats her heart for the first time. Here's the thing, when we start talking about other beings and other forms of life, is that the souls of the Jotun they go back to Virgilmere. They don't go to Earthswell. They don't go to Helheim. And this all ties into why we have like a Filia that comes to us in our death and that stays with our life. And in our death, they guide us back to Helheim. This is why we have to be guided. And they protect us on that journey to there. And we can get into this maybe at the end of this episode or probably the next one, but there are things that can happen to your soul after you're done if under certain conditions or circumstances. For example, a Jotun can actually grab your soul if your Filia is not protecting it. That's the purpose of like the Valkyries, you know. Have you ever heard anything about that?
No, I haven't, but that's a scary thought.
Without going too in-depth in that aspect of it yet, this kind of sets the scene where Rig, the gods, decide to send a god to men to actually teach them. Because at this point in time, it's most likely, in my opinion, Gulveig came before Rig. And not only was she like causing malformations with people, this is like her second time after she's been killed by the gods for causing malformations. Her soul, actually, she's able to actually regenerate her soul into another being to be born again, right? Because she is called in the Lord, you know, thrice killed and thrice born. The one killed three times, the one born three times. And mm-hmm. So at some point, either the second or third time she's reborn, she comes to Earth and she starts actually mating with the men and causing corruption and teaching them Sather. And at this point, she had kind of also taught Freya. The people think that one that came and taught Sather the gods, it was actually Gulveig Hyde that had taught Sather to Freya. And Freya did spread it amongst the gods because she had learned it. And at this point in the story, the gods don't see the consequences that everything happened. And we'll have to get into Gulveig Hyde a little bit over the next several episodes because her story is actually really deep. But when she is among men, she is spreading like a confusion among them about their natural state of things, because that's what the god's purpose was to create a natural state form of beings that followed order. So they sent Rig to Earth, to Mannheim, where our folk lived. And they, at that point, he bred with three different families. So what do you know about the story of Rig? It's mostly captured in Rigsthula.
Just a quick recap. Rig comes down and he meets a very poor family whose names translate out to great-grandfather and great-grandmother. They invite him in, and they're only able to give him a meager meal, but, you know, they give him what they can. And then he sleeps between them. After he leaves, great-grandmother gives birth to, I believe the child's name was Thrall, and from him, all the lines of thralls come from. And then Rig's next stop was grandmother and grandfather. They're a little bit better off, and so they're able to give him a nicer meal, and he sleeps between them. And after he leaves, grandmother gives birth to Carl. And from him, all the lines of Carl's come from. And then his third and last stop was to mother and father. And they are significantly better off than even great-grandmother and great-grandfather. And so they're able to lavish him with things. And he sleeps between them. And after he leaves, they give birth to, mother gives birth to Jarl. And from him, all the Jarls and things of that nature come from.
That's exactly how the story is told. And there's a lot of layers to this story as well, because you can see in it that we're talking about different generations of him actually coming. The lore doesn't say specifically like he slept with great-grandmother or whatever, but it certainly implies it. He lays in between the bed, essentially cuckolding the other father, the husband. And then it says he was there for three nights And then 9 months later, a child was born. So it's definitely implying that Rig mated with that woman and caused that child to be born.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they had artificial insemination at that point.
You know what's interesting about the story is some stories just have Rig appearing and then, as you know, going door to door. And then other stories actually have tales about him being sent in like a ship and then coming across the sea and then him being found and raised. And he came with certain tools like the fire auger, the chaff of wheat, in the runes, right?
Yeah.
So I know that some people have argued that this is, you know, a Christian injection of the story of Moses and the Red Sea, you know, and floating down the river and all this sort of thing. I don't agree with that position. And the reason why is because I think that we see this same symbolism and myth from all sorts of cultures about people coming over some sort of ships. And in other parts of our myth, like, for example, with the ship Nalfari and other ships that are described in our lore as traveling very fast, you know, and I think that it was in the language of our people to this is how they would describe things that were people could travel on in their words. And that not necessarily we can understand what came here. Was it aliens? You know, is the alien theory our religion? I don't know, per se. I don't necessarily negate the fact that in some way, because the lore constantly describes different ways that the gods have traveled, you know, over cosmic proportions of space and time. So whatever that means or method there, I don't see any type of contradiction of authenticity with a story that describes a god being sent to man, to our folk, via some sort of vehicle transport.
Well, and I think it's also important on that same concept that when, I mean, not just in our faith, but in faiths across the world, when a divine being comes down to our realm, even though they are divine beings, even though they are gods and goddesses, when they come down to our level, they still have to abide by the natural laws of our realm. They're able to work within them to a greater degree than we are. But, you know, if Rig came down to Mannheim, he came down to our realm, he would still, in my opinion, have to move around with a boat. Or a horse, or however, think of any way that people were getting around back then.
Right. Very good point. And that is actually a broader point that's important to point out is that not only are there laws for us, not just man-made laws, but there are universal laws that apply to everything in creation. And even the gods are bound by Orlok, natural law. Their fate and their abilities are only granted by the laws of Orlok. So that's a really good point that you brought up there. Whether he came by ship or just appeared, I tend to believe the lore about him coming in a ship because he would need to be raised among men for them to know him and recognize him for what he was. That he was different, that he had something different about him, a different soul or essence, if that makes sense.
Yeah, he would have had to have been around for a while and interacted with people for them to be able to recognize that he is more than what they are.
Exactly. So Rig, when people recognize that he possesses knowledge beyond what they knew, Rig actually began teaching the folk everything that we needed. He taught us the laws of life, how to build society and civilization. He brought culture. He brought a fire auger to teach us how to use it to create the need fire. He taught us our religion, how to connect with the gods and ask favor from them. He brought all of this to us. And then he bred with three different families. And it is interesting that no matter what the gift was that each family gave, that each family was still blessed with a child to carry on their bloodlines. But what is even more interesting is that the only child that Rig slash Heimdall actually claimed was Jarl. He's the only one in the story where Rig appears from the woods after his birth and takes the child and claims him. So for those who don't know, it is a Germanic tradition upon the birth of a child that the father would stand above the child. The child would be on the ground naked, and the father would stand above him and look at the child. And if he recognized the child and acknowledged him, then from that day forward, that child was that man's. It assumed his soul.
So I thought that it was Jarl's son, Connor, that Rig acknowledged.
No, it was Jarl that Rig acknowledged. And Jarl taught Rig all of the secrets of the runes. He taught him all of the secrets of the faith. And he also taught Colner as well during the same period when Colner was growing. But Jarl was the child that Rig acknowledged.
Okay.
But aspect to understand the folk soul, because that birth and that recognition of the Jarl line is a recognition. And although all three lines are divine, that recognition of Jarl being his child was the recognition and the authority being passed of essentially the spiritual maintainment of the folk, the teachings, to carry on the traditions, that it would be their responsibility to carry on those same sacred duties that Heimdall has himself. And who is Heimdall? He guards the Bifrost. He's the one that allows things to pass through to Asgard. They must go through Heimdall. He is the protector of it. And the Jarl line of the Riggs bloodline, are the folk that have been entrusted with that duty to protect the sacred knowledge and the spiritual teaching of the broader folk, the Carl lines and the Thrall lines. Now, I know that this clashes with modern concepts and understandings of what Jarls and Earls and Carls and Thralls and whatnot are, because what happened over time, which was during the Christianization of Europe, was that these no longer became spiritual qualities inherent in the soul of each class of people. It became more of a social recognition of a person's class. I am completely against that concept of how the soul folk or the folk soul works. And I'm completely against that classification of the three lines of Rig. That what we are dealing with when Rig bred these lines is aspects of the soul, the qualities of those souls that each people would have.
So obviously the Jarls were, you know, kings, Gothis, Githias, any embodying anything that today we would call a leadership type person. Where would you say the difference, for those that don't know, how would you explain the differences between, say, a Carl and a Thrall from our ancestors' perspective?
Well, originally I would say, going back at ancient roots, you know, the concept evolved over time and how people understood what those were. And that had to do with outside and foreign influences coming in. Originally, you know, by the laws of Rig that were given to us, you know, all of the folk were to maintain peace with each other and live together in harmony and in the betterment of the folk. And we can look at it in modern terms today, where we see people have different sorts of dispositions about them. And I'm not trying to be cruel or mean or anything like that, or I don't care about political correctness or any of that nonsense, but there are people that are just smarter than other people. There are people that have mental, you know, incapacities. There are people that are more spiritual than other people. There are people of all sorts of natures. There's some people that's more of a warrior spirit than other people. And I look at it as those being natural qualities of the essence of the soul, which identify them with what branch or line that they come from.
I would agree with that. The reason that I wanted you to kind of explain that in a little more depth than I could is because when most people hear thrall, they automatically think slave. And while the thralls were the laborers, they were not necessarily slave labor like how we would think about it today.
Exactly. In fact, I mean, everybody listening to this has probably a friend, somebody they know that's just a workaholic. That's what they like to do. They just like to go out. They like to build things. They like to just constantly work. It's just, that's the nature of their being. That's the nature of who they are. You know, and this is something that you can't get away from. In fact, one of the kindreds up north, you know, we have a brother up north that he just loves building houses. And that's just what he does. You know, he just loves it. Constantly talk to him about finding other work, but he's like, and he just really likes to make things with his hands. It's just in the essence of his soul too, you know?
Yeah.
So not to say that somebody builds houses is a thrall, because I definitely don't think he's a thrall by any means, but there's different dispositions of soul. And the way that it works in inheritance, almost every people in the world, except for one exclusive people, follows their patrilineal line. You can look back in history and just see how many people trace their lines through their fathers. And it was always a very important thing to do. And this is because the way our folk understood the way the soul passes was it passed from the father to the son. And we can kind of see it with modern DNA where we have these haplogroups where we can say, okay, well, the line definitely comes from these sources right here, you know? So very similar to that. And I see Rig coming as like defining various haplogroups of folk, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, to me it does.
Which brings up another really interesting scientific genetic point in a conversation that we can mention too, is because in the lore, when Rig comes, it actually does give physical descriptions of the children that he has. And these physical descriptions, you know, the eyes, the piercing eyes of like a snake, right? It's describing the lines, which essentially was a way of them to describe blue eyes. That blue eyes are said to come from Rig, which genetically and scientifically, just today, acknowledge that every single blue-eyed person that is alive today all comes from a single ancestor that they can trace back to about 1,000 years ago. And then on top of that, that ancestor that they can trace back, that sample that they found, is in like the Caucasus regions where they say our folk originated from, right?
Uh-huh.
So I've always found this really interesting because that would be very, very indicative of a timeline for us when events happen. I heard another geneticist arguing, though, it wasn't 10,000 years ago, that it was more like probably 36 to 40,000 years ago. And it probably happened at like the time of like the Neanderthal.
Uh-huh.
But mainstream geneticists, they attribute blue eyes to a mutation that happened. But I feel that just because they don't actually know how mutation happened, they're just theorizing the way the blue eyes came was from a mutation of a gene, right?
Uh-huh.
But my point is what actually caused that mutation? Was it Rig?
It would make sense to me. you know, like what we would call a mutation could be a physical response to a child getting acknowledged by the divine, you know, that something would change in that child to differentiate him and anyone that comes after him from the others.
I don't know. That's just one of my weird tandems I had to kind of throw in there because I've always been fascinated by that correlation there in the descriptions that they give of each of the lines. But it is important for us to understand that when Rig gave us the laws, it was for all of the folk, all of the lines, the Thrall, the Carl, and the Jarls. They all had to abide by them.
Yeah.
So, and this was to protect the folk. And then on the other side of it, we have Gulveig Hyde, whom the lore describes as the bitch that breeds mutts with Loki, right?
Yeah.
So she's out there breeding with folk too, causing all this misinformation and essentially teaching people how to be against the gods in order and everything for which they stood for. Because she is still trying to overthrow them and destroy them.
I had something great and I lost it.
Braid fart. It's all right. Well, you know, and the thing is when we start seeing this relationship with how Ingrabota would go door to door, spreading her misinformation, in teaching people a false way of living and changing their natural relationship with the gods is what she was doing. Then we have Rig coming and actually breeding a line from the gods in this earth that would be here as essentially people to bring order and build civilization and culture to the world.
Yeah.
So, and I definitely take a pan-Germanic view of our religion. Like, I don't believe in all this tribalism where everybody thinks that the story was different for everybody. We kind of dove into that last week. So no need to do it this week. But I see this as being the history of our people as a whole throughout Europe.
Yeah, and to just kind of touch on those differences real quick, I definitely think that the different approaches have an importance, but realistically they're minor differences. So to separate ourselves based on, oh, I look at this coming from an Anglo-Saxon perspective or a Norse Icelandic perspective or a Germanic perception or wherever you're approaching it from, like, this is about our folk and we're all the same people. So those little differences in names or practices that, you know, just kind of different peoples naturally do certain things just a little bit different. Like, that doesn't mean that we're different.
Exactly. And I know, since we're kind of touching on this, I know last week after our episode, you had mentioned like we should explain why we reference like Vedic information or Vedic texts. So for those who don't know, as we mentioned earlier in the show about the Indo-Europeans and them spreading, they also spread into Southwest Asia, which would be Persia, Iran, and India. And they have the oldest body of texts of, they call themselves Aryans. And they have the oldest body of texts that survived over, I don't know, 3,000 years or so now. And a lot of times people will constantly try to gravitate to that and they interpret like Hinduism. It's always strange how Europeans are very attracted to Hinduism. I always found that kind of an odd correlation because it is actually somewhat related. It's like a cousin faith, but Hinduism as it is today is a mix of a completely different people, Dravidians, that ended up mixing with the Indo-Europeans that conquered India. And they changed the religion over time. The texts become more and more Dravidian with more and more Dravidian gods over time. So it is unreliable. But the reason why we refer back to it is goes back to what I had mentioned earlier in the show tonight, was that we can look for correlations. Like when we see something in our lore, we can look back and say, well, does this exist in another Indo-European tradition, or is this something unique? And then if we can find it in Slavic or Greek or Roman or Vedic traditions, then we have that correlation there as it being something that was very probable. So now, on top of that, I do have to stress this, because there seems to be a movement nowadays where people gravitate to this Vedic tradition, and they're very much Germanic folk, but they gravitate to this because they have this pan-Indo-European perception of trying to restore the religion of the most ancient folk. The problem with that is that when our folk migrated to different areas, they all accumulated their own unique history and memory that went on and was taught from generation to generation. And the gods interacted with the different folks at different periods of time. So our Germanic history, Nordic history, may be slightly different than Slavic's. The Romans and Greeks, on the other hand, that's a completely different story of trying to really find information that corresponds to ours, although there are some correspondences, because the Greeks and the Romans, they had a habit of syncretizing with foreign religions. When they would go conquer foreign peoples in Africa, for example, they would actually pray to those gods of those people they were fighting, asking those gods for victory, and that if they would be granted victory, they would erect their idols in Rome and worship them. So that's kind of how their tradition and their religion became corrupted over time. So it's less reliable for actually make too many comparisons to.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I believe I read that like Rome even had a pillar or a whole temple dedicated to what they call the unnamed god, you know, just to even like, just to make sure they didn't leave anyone out. They had this one random where you could go and it was just the forgotten god or the forgotten gods. Like they really like pulled in everything, and we see how well that worked.
Yeah. You notice every time any culture or society or civilization begins integrating, like you just said, with other cultures and other societies, the whole concept of multiculturalism, that the original society dies and it is destroyed and goes away.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, it just dilutes everything to where none of it has any, it loses all of its meaning, you know, and as especially spiritual things, like, if it gets to the point where it loses its meaning, it loses its power.
And that's how I look at like a lot of people today, where they get this identitarian view of, I guess, our faith or religion. And this is the surface level, you know, where it's a book with a really nice cover, but there's nothing written in your pages of your book there. You know, it's like there's a lot more depth to it. There's a lot more information along with that. And I did want to get to the souls a little bit. I are running out of time here. But next episode, I want to dedicate the next episode to talking about the soul, pretty much for most of the episode, go over how it works, because this all ties together with Rig coming, breeding our lines. And then Volvig Hyde out there breeding as well, and causing confusion and getting misinformation and causing malformations and whatnot. So our ancestors began to grow and to learn and to teach their knowledge and understanding to future generations. What Heimdall taught is sacred to men, and the implements he brought are eternally honored and revered. While later technologies would replace those given to the most ancient forefathers, Heimdall's tool shall always be remembered in tradition and ceremony. The sacred lore of the Runar, which Heimdall taught as much to the humans as is useful to know, was originally in Mimir's possession. This holy art, which came to mankind from the Gauvin, is called Galdr. In ancient times, arrangements had already been made to spread the knowledge of Galdr among all beings. He instructed the humans in the degrees of the Nornir for an honest life, taught them what true freedom is, and how the people ought to live in love in order to win blessings from the Gauvin. From this lore came the nine virtues of honesty and honor, wisdom, generosity, kindness, courage, loyalty, independence, and piety. He also taught the first law, which we call the Runelag. When he felt they were ready, Heimdall called his children together in Arvagnland. There he gave them the law, the Runelag, and said, "Let it be your pathfinder, so that nothing shall ever go ill."
This has been the Sacred Stew. I am Anthony, this and my co-host James. Y'all have a good night.